Isaiah chapter 14. It's not surprising that there is so much concerning Babylon in the Old Testament scriptures when we consider her antiquity and importance and the extent of her influence upon the nations and Israel. It's only in harmony with the fact that we are very much concerning Rome in the New Testament scriptures, especially Revelation. For the same obvious reason that her position and importance and intimate and antagonistic relation to the divine purpose required it. It's easy to realize this in connection with Rome, the modern Babylon. The city remains with the monuments on which Paul and the first century Christians set eyes. And the influence of Rome is indelibly engraven on all the civilized world. But it requires greater effort to realize the grandeur and influence of ancient Babylon, which was, in the mind of God, related to that of Rome as gold is to iron. For by these two metals, the two dominions are represented by God to Nebuchadnezzar of old. Scriptural and historical study, however, will soon reveal the fact that if apostate Christendom be related to Rome as its mother, Babylon, whose name is symbolically named upon it, is unquestionably the grandmother and first parent in the genealogy. It will surprise those who may for the first time undertake the quest to discover how directly related are all the fables of Roman Catholic superstition to the ancient myths of Babylon. It is indeed an unenlightened handling of these facts that has given opportunity to blaspheme, to a skepticism which mistakes the fables of the apostasy for the truth of the scriptures which so roundly condemns them. Babylon, then, as the seat of the golden head dominion of the kingdoms of men, comes in for particular notice and reprobation at the hands of God by the prophets. By God's power and munificence, she had her magnificence and wealth. By him, she was used as his weapon in the chastisement of nations, even of Israel, but she did not honor him, but wrought in pride for her own glory, exulting against the chosen nation and insulting God to honor Bel, Nebo, and Merodach. Isaiah, by the Spirit, assured all who had ears to hear that God was not unmindful of these things, but that down to the minutest details they were taken account of and provided for in the overruling counsels of the Most High. And by him was revealed in Israel, not only the downfall of Babylon, but the many striking details therewith connected, which, like the judgments of the Exodus from Egypt, should through all subsequent ages stand as a witness for God and the truth of his word. The weapons of God's warfare against Babylon were declared beforehand by the prophet to be his sanctified ones, the Medes and Persians. And their victorious commander was named Cyrus by God nearly 200 years before his birth. And the prophet saw beforehand Lucifer's fall from heaven. He saw the night of pleasure that was turned into fear and destruction. And the river of Babylon in which he boasted was dried up and made the channel of attack. The brazen gates, Isaiah declared, God would open before Cyrus. In Isaiah and Jeremiah, Bel, Nebo, and Merodach, like the gods of Egypt before them, were exhibited as the subjects of divine judgment and contempt. And the astrologers are challenged and disgraced. Looking at these features in detail as they come before us, we are first presented by Isaiah in his 14th chapter with the taunting parable with which Israel should celebrate Lucifer's fall from heaven. The relation of the divinely decreed destruction of Babylon to the hope of Israel is thus expressed in the opening of the chapter. For the Lord will yet have mercy on Jacob and will yet choose Israel and set them in their own land. And strangers shall be joined with them, and they shall cleave to the house of Jacob, and the people shall take them and bring them to their place. And the house of Israel shall possess them in the land of the Lord for servants and handmaids. And they shall take them captive, whose captives they were, and they shall rule over their oppressors. It was when this relief from the Babylonian captivity was experienced that Israel was to take up the proverb or parable expressed in the fourth and following verses. There can be no mistake about the object of the taunting speech in question. It is the king of Babylon who smote the people in wrath with a continual stroke. He was the broken staff and scepter, the fallen tree, over whose hewing down the firs and cedars of Lebanon were comforted. All this is so obvious that it seems almost an insult to intelligence to rehearse it. But when we have the surprising fact before us that the context is referred by many to the devil of popular belief, an imaginary king of an equally imaginary hell, the insistence on these obvious facts is seen to be neither unnecessary nor unreasonable. Hell from beneath is moved to meet thee at thy coming, says the parable. That is, the grave, as the margin of the Authorized Version rightly expresses it, the hell of the dead, the grave where the worm is spread under thee and the worms cover thee. Or as it is expressed, thou shalt be brought down to hell, that is Sheol, the same word translated grave, and in verse 11 and many other places, to the sides of the pit. This hell is gravedom, or the dominion of the grave, located in the ground, a land of darkness, a place of forgetfulness and silence, a place of dead bodies and worms. The other hell, the imaginary place of torment, located nobody can imagine where, is a pagan fiction of Babylonian origin. The figure of the dead speaking is as intelligible as that of the trees rejoicing, and is not confined to this parable. Its most striking illustration is found in the parable of the rich man and Lazarus, the imagery of which has something in common with that of Isaiah 14 and is similarly misinterpreted. But the words that give pause to those uninstructed in the first principles of the truth are those of verse 12. How art thou fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, son of the morning? How art thou cast down to the ground which didst weaken the nations? Such language can have but one meaning to them, portraying the fall from heaven of their Satan, the archangel who was cast out of heaven for rebellion and with his hosts established those traditional infernal regions which an apostate Christianity has borrowed from pagan mythology. If this were true, we should be compelled to question whether heaven were a finality of blessedness, since rebellion would be possible even there. But seeing that the language indisputably refers to the king of Babylon, the only question arising is, how do such descriptions fit the case? Lucifer, in the Authorized Version, is of Latin origin and signifies simply light bearer. The margin gives day star as an alternative, and the Revised Version has transferred this to the text. This was the idea of the Septuagint translators, who so rendered the Hebrew word, which itself simply means shining, coming from a verb, the primary meaning of which is to shine. Day star, son of the morning, or dawn as an appellation of the king of Babylon, recalls The sun, moon, and star worship of Merodach, god of light, and challenges comparison with the titles the bright and morning star, the star of Jacob, applied to Zion's king, of whose dominion Isaiah and all the prophets speak, in assurance of its ultimate triumph over all the gods and the whole kingdom of Babylon. The ambitions of Lucifer aimed at the perpetual exaltation of the Babylonian heavens above the Israelitish, but God had decreed otherwise. The Babylonian heavens comprised the royalty and ruling classes of her political aerial, and the corresponding things obtained in Israel. Moses, addressing the congregation of Israel, began, "Give ear, O ye heavens, and I will speak, and hear, O earth, the words of my mouth." Babylon, prevailing over Israel, brought these heavens under eclipse, and Lucifer's ambition is thus paraphrased, "Thou hast said in thine heart, I will ascend into heaven, I will exalt my throne above the stars of God. I will sit also upon the mount of the congregation in the sides of the north. I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I will be like the Most High." Here, to exalt the throne above the stars of God is to sit upon the mount of the congregation, that is, Mount Zion, where the bright and shining lights of Israel shone, and where Israel's morning star is yet to be enthroned. Somewhat similar language is addressed by Ezekiel to the king of Tyre, whose dominion in the days of David and Solomon had been in alliance with Israel, but who, for his pride, was, like Lucifer, condemned to an ignominious downfall. And Daniel, speaking of the Roman power that should prevail over Israel, said, "It waxed great, even to the host of heaven, and it cast down some of the host and of the stars to the ground, and stamped upon them. Yea, he magnified himself even against the prince of the host," that is Christ, Israel's morning star, "and by him the daily sacrifice was taken away, and the place of his sanctuary cast down." Thus, the language of Isaiah concerning Lucifer is quite in harmony with other prophecies concerning Gentile movements and presumptions against the kingdom of God in Israel. But it is grotesquely inapplicable to the supposed revolt in heaven, God's dwelling place, and the casting out thence of the Satan of popular belief. Lucifer was the king of Babylon, a man that made the earth tremble, who for his offences was divinely decreed to go down to a dishonoured grave, being denied the rights of a kingly burial. The Babylonian monarch, whose fate answers to the details of Isaiah's prophecies here and elsewhere, as well as to those of Jeremiah and Daniel, was Belshazzar. And of his fall from heaven, the latter prophet was witness, and in it he was deeply concerned. And this introduces the night of pleasure turned into fear and destruction. In the 21st chapter, Isaiah had a grievous vision of the siege of Babylon by the Medes and Persians, and he speaks, as it were, from the very point of view of the king of Babylon in the siege. "Therefore are my loins filled with pain, pangs have taken hold upon me as the pangs of a woman that travaileth. I was bowed down at the hearing of it, I was dismayed at the seeing of it, my heart panted, fearfulness affrighted me. The night of my pleasure hath he turned into fear unto me." prepare the table, watch in the watchtower, eat, drink, arise ye princes, and anoint the shield. Human ingenuity can, with suitable apparatus, reproduce the sights and sounds of the past. Only God can give beforehand the impressions of the future. And here's a striking one of many illustrations in Isaiah's beholding, nearly 200 years beforehand, Belshazzar's night of carousels, carousals, his loin-racking dismay at the writing on the wall, the interruption of the feast by the sudden call to arms, the fall of Babylon and her gods, and her speedy conversion into Jehovah's threshing floor at the hands of Cyrus. Both scripture and profane history tell us of Belshazzar's feast. Daniel in chapter 5 gives us the divine account with which every Bible reader is familiar. It brings the true issues clearly before us. Israel's God as against the gods of Babylon. The temple which was in Jerusalem as opposed to the house of his God in the land of Shinar. The worship of the God of Israel in antagonism to the Babylonian system. When the gold and silver vessels of the temple at Belshazzar's command were brought in, and they drank wine and praised the gods of gold and of silver and of brass and of iron and of wood and of stone, the angelic handwriting on the wall reduced them at once to the state of abject terror depicted by Isaiah so long beforehand. The writer was invisible, save the hand that wrote, and traced upon the plaster, over against the candlestick, the brief, indecipherable sentence of the doom of Babylon. The unintelligible characters heightened the king's fear. What was to be done? The most natural and obvious thing was done. The king called the astrologers, Chaldeans and soothsayers, and all the wise men of Babylon. What could they do? They were helpless in the presence of this mysterious divine inscription, as they had been before Nebuchadnezzar when he demanded them first the rehearsal of his forgotten dream and then the interpretation of it. Their ignorance and impotence had been the subject of Isaiah's prophecy when he denounced upon Babylon loss of children and widowhood in one day. Before the multitude of thy sorceries and for the great abundance of thy enchantment. And by the Spirit of God he thus challenged these pretenders. Stand now with thine enchantments and with the multitude of thy sorceries wherein thou hast laboured from thy youth. If so be thou shalt be able to profit, if so be thou mayest prevail, thou art wearied in the multitude of thy counsels. Let now the astrologers, the stargazers, the monthly prognosticators, stand up and save thee from these things that shall come upon thee. Behold, they shall be as stubble. The fire shall burn them. They shall not deliver themselves from the power of the flame. There shall not be coal to warm at, nor fire to sit before it. Thus shall they be unto thee with whom thou hast laboured, even thy merchants from thy youth. They shall wander every one to his quarter, and none shall save thee. And now of Babylon's hour had come, as Isaiah had foretold. Evil was upon her, and she knew not whence it arose. The vengeance of the temple was about to be poured upon the desecrator of the vessels thereof, and before the handwriting on the palace wall stood the astrologers in helpless ignorance, ready to be destroyed, powerless to deliver themselves, as Isaiah had said. But the exposure of the astrologers was the occasion of the manifestation of God's prophet. Daniel, in brief and stern rehearsal of Nebuchadnezzar's experiences, rebuked Belshazzar, who sinned against the light, in humbling not his heart, though he knew all this. He then read and interpreted the handwriting on the wall, which in four words, numbered, weighed, divided, decreed the end of the kingdom of Babylon, and in that night was Belshazzar, the king of the Chaldeans, slain. Probably many of the astrologers fell before the sword of Cyrus, but Daniel escaped and came to honor under Darius. One of the boasts of Babylon was its beautiful river, which ran through the midst of the city, walled on either side along its entire course. The walls were each pierced with 25 gates corresponding to the lines of the streets of the city, and between these gates and massive quays adjoining, ferry boats continually plied. And the river was bridged in the centre of the city by a drawbridge which connected the two great palaces. And besides the river, there was the immense reservoir already alluded to. Water was superabundant, and the great extent of open land within the walls permitted the growth of a large supply of grain. It was estimated that the city could successfully withstand a siege of 20 years at least. And the citizens seemed safe in their amusement of insulting Cyrus and his army from the walls. But the river was marked out beforehand by God as the line of attack. And it suited Cyrus very well to let it be supposed that his purpose was to reduce the city by famine. O thou that dwellest on many waters, said Jeremiah, thine end is come. A drought is upon her waters, and they shall be dried up, for it is the land of graven images. One post shall run to meet another, and one messenger to meet another, to show the king of Babylon that his city is taken at the end. And the passages are surprised, and the reeds they are burned with fire, and the men of war are affrighted. I will dry up her sea and make her springs dry. How all this was accomplished, every reader of ancient history knows. Cyrus, under cover of constructing simple entrenchments and imprisoning embankments of vast extent, really excavated an immense channel for the diversion of the river. The stratagem and the scale upon which it was carried out were worthy of the man, but of course we remember that both the plan and the man were of the Lord. When the work was completed, and on the night of Belshazzar's feast, the waters were turned, and the way through the heart of the city laid bare. But even so, it was not plain sailing. For the interior walls and gates remained, and had these all been efficiently watched and manned, the forces of that memorable night march might only have walked into a trap after all. But the gates shall not be shut, so God had declared by Isaiah. Thus saith the Lord to his anointed, to Cyrus, whose right hand I have holden to subdue nations before him. And I will loose the loins of kings to open before him the two-leaved gates, and the gates shall not be shut. I will go before thee and make the crooked places straight. I will break in pieces the gates of brass, and cut in sunder the bars of iron. And so, when the time came, the gates were not shut, and the forces under Gobryas and Gadatas, advancing to the heart of the city from the north and south in the riverbed, were soon in the palace, and having slain the king, took the city with little further resistance. From time to time in human history, there have been crises at which it has pleased God to make himself known by the judgments which he executes. Generations following soon forget these judgments, for in the flesh dwelleth no good thing. But the facts remain. In every generation, the remnants that may have come under the power of the word has taken heed to the record of these facts and remembered them in the hope of the day of final vindication. It is so still. We read of the destruction in Noah's flood of the world of the ungodly and remember Christ's impressive application of it to the day of his coming. We read of the events of the Egyptian Exodus and the judgment upon the gods of Egypt. And remember that it is written in the prophet Micah that marvelous things are to come on the nations after that same pattern. We read of the destruction of Sennacherib's army and his own assassination in the presence of his God at Nineveh, in whose name he had defied the God of Jerusalem. Now we read of the judgment of God upon the idols of Babylon, and remember that there is still a Babylon adoring phantoms vain as wood and stone, against which adoration we earnestly protest, exhorting men to turn to God from idols and serve the living and the true God and wait for his Son from heaven. Daniel in Babylon revealed to them the true God, whose works the court ought to remember, but they were mad upon their idols. God had foretold the overthrow of these. Isaiah had said, Bel boweth down, Nebo stoopeth. Their idols were upon the beasts and upon the cattle. Your carriages were heavy laden. They are a burden to the weary beast. They stoop. They bow down together. They could not deliver the burden, but themselves had gone into captivity. And the chapter goes on to appeal to Israel to hearken to God and not idols, the work of men's hands. To God who, in his majesty and foresight, had called Cyrus as a ravenous bird to execute his judgment on Babylon. And this chapter closes with the assurance of a final manifestation of righteousness and salvation in Zion. Jeremiah's emphatic denunciation of judgment against Babylon commences thus. Babylon is taken, Bel is confounded, Merodach is broken in pieces, her idols are confounded, her images are broken in pieces. And in explanation of the divine judgment, he further says, the Lord of hosts hath sworn by himself, saying, surely I will fill thee with men as with caterpillars, and they shall lift up a shout against thee. He hath made the earth by his power, he hath established the world by his wisdom, and hath stretched out the heaven by his understanding. This was a repudiation of Bel and Merodach, to whom Babylonian superstition attributed these mighty works, and in whose sun, moon, and star worship they thought to prevail against the God of Israel and the land and nation. He had, for a period of 70 years, delivered over to them for punishment. That there should be no perpetuation of Babylonian error concerning this, God said, I will punish Bel in Babylon, and I will bring forth out of his mouth that which he hath swallowed up, and the nation shall not flow together any more unto him. Yea, the wall of Babylon shall fall. The names of Bel, Nebo, and Merodach have been recovered. Many of the inscriptions from Babylon. Nebo was the Babylonian god of learning and represented the scribes and priests, while Bel had apparently more to do with the civil power. Merodach was the god of light, son of dawn and of spring. One of the inscriptions of Nebuchadnezzar the Great, which has been preserved to our day, shows his worship of Merodach. It is known as the India House inscription, being now in the India office, and gives an account of the rebuilding of more than 20 temples in Babylon and Borsippa, of the strengthening of the fortifications of the city, and of the making of the great quays beside the river. It confirms the truth of Daniel, which tells us how the king, in admiration of his work, spake and said, "Is not this great Babylon that I have built?" Daniel had told him that it was by the power of the Most High, who ruleth in the kingdoms of men, and who would humble him in an unprecedented manner. But Nebuchadnezzar attributed his power to Merodach and the gods of Babylon. Hence, this inscription concludes with the following prayer. "To Merodach, my lord, I prayed, I lifted up my hands. Merodach, lord, wisest of gods, glorious prince, thou it was who madest me, and with the sovereignty of all mankind didst invest me. Like dear life, I love thy lofty image above thine own city, Babylon. I have adorned no town in any place, like as I love the fear of thy godhead and regard thy lordship. Favour thou the lifting up of my hands. Hear my prayer. I am the patron king that rejoiceth thine heart, the prudent minister, the patron of all thy cities. By thy command, O merciful Merodach, may the house I have built endure forever. May I be satisfied with the fullness of it, and therein may I come to grey hairs and be satisfied with children. May I receive therein the rich tributes of the kings of the regions of all mankind, from horizon to zenith, the places of the rising sun. May I own have none to make me afraid. Let my offspring therein rule the black-headed folk forevermore." But Merodach could not preserve Nebuchadnezzar from humiliation, nor save his own city, Babylon. 2,500 years have passed away, and the fragmentary evidences of his hypothetical existence are found in the museums of the Gentiles of the Far West, whose careless multitudes, strolling by them, wonder at the childishness of the mighty ones of long ago. Here and there, a more enlightened spectator, passing by with the prophetic word in hand and heart, wonders in another way, and his heart rises in thankful worship to the Lord God of Israel, who brought these vanities to nothing and has preserved his own nation of Israel against the setting up of the kingdom of which Daniel spoke to the Babylonian kings. The taking of Babylon by Cyrus was only the beginning of the end. The prophecy required that it should be as when God overthrew Sodom and Gomorrah. First of all, it ceased to be a royal city, the Persian kings preferring Susa, Ecbatana, or Persepolis. The Macedonian kings built Seleucia, which drew away the population of Babylon and caused it to be deserted. At last, the city was entirely forsaken, so that Pausanias, who wrote about the time that John received the revelation, that is, AD 96, took occasion to remark that of the once greatest city of the world, nothing more then remained than the walls. The prophecies that it should become a habitation of wild beasts were literally fulfilled by the action of the Persian kings in converting the desolate city into a hunting park. At last, even the walls began to crumble and fall, and the debris blocking the river caused it to divert, possibly to the course of Cyrus's artificial channel, while the diminished flow that came through the city spread out at last into marshes. Thus it degenerated into pools of water, a most unlikely thing from a merely human point of view, for if there is a stable landmark in the world, it is a city on a river. Witness Rome on the Tiber, or even London on the Thames. The combined effect of all these things was the manifested fulfillment of the prophetic declaration, I will make it a possession for the bittern and pools of water, and I will sweep it with the besom of destruction, saith the Lord of hosts. So effectual was the sweeping that Rollin, who flourished 1661 to 1741, declares that the most able geographers at this day cannot determine the place where it stood. The explorations of the 19th century have revealed the site of Babylon, and very many interesting confirmations of the truth of the scriptures. The 20th century will see many of the eyewitnesses have vanished from the land of the living, the children of Zion reaching their king. The last verses of Isaiah's 14th chapter look far beyond the fall and desolation of ancient Babylon and contemplate judgments which are still in the future. In the nature of things, it is only in the time of the end that the full scope of the prophecy becomes visible, and by the deep conviction produced of its divine author, it compensates somewhat for the absence of the old vision that the prophets enjoyed in Israel. Passing on from God's declaration concerning Babylon, I will sweep it with a besom of destruction. The next verses run thus. The Lord of hosts hath warned, saying, surely as I have thought, shall it come to pass, and as I have purposed, so shall it stand, that I will break the Assyrian in my land, and upon my mountains tread him underfoot. Then shall his yoke depart from off them, and his burden depart from off their shoulders. This is the purpose that is purposed upon the whole earth, and this is the hand that is stretched out upon all the nations. For the Lord of hosts hath purposed, who shall disannul it? And his hand is stretched out, and who shall turn it back? Isaiah had already testified that the final breaking of the yoke from off the neck of Israel should be because of the anointing, and should come by the hand of the promised Son of God and of David. The association of the idea with the downfall of Babylon cannot be supposed to be accidental. And when we come to know all that is testified of and by the Son of David, we see clearly the design of it. Assyria and Babylonia have their modern counterparts in senses geographical and spiritual. The prophets of Israel and their ministry did not cease with Malachi. To stop with him would be to leave out the greatest of the prophets, even the prophet like unto Moses, who was worthy of more glory than Moses, inasmuch as he who hath builded the house hath more honour than the house. And in building the house, he said to the scribes and Pharisees, behold, I send unto you prophets and wise men and scribes. And some of them ye shall kill and crucify, and some of them ye shall scourge in your synagogues and persecute them from city to city. And among these was John, the beloved disciple, who when banished to the Isle of Patmos beheld in vision among the things that would come to pass thereafter the final judgment of the great Roman system, which under the figure of the great whore that sitteth upon many waters, corrupted, enslaved, and destroyed the nations, Babylon the Great, mother of harlots, and abominations of the earth. This is the legend upon the forehead of the symbolic woman who in the last verse of Revelation 27 is explained to be that great city which reigneth over the kings of the earth. There is thus no escape from the conclusion that Rome, subsequently to AD 96 and down to the time of her revealed destruction at the hands of the Lord, is before the world defined by Jesus as the modern representative of ancient Babylon.